Good morning, everyone. This is Sydney Isaacs. I'm a managing director at Abernathy McGregor in our Houston office, and I'll be moderating today's discussion. My work at Abernathy is focused on advising companies on communications and investor relations, especially during times of change like M&A, crisis, and bankruptcy. With me today are two panelists that I'm honored to have with us. The first is Al Petrie, who is a senior partner at Al Petrie Advisors, providing investor relations and financial analysis counsel to companies across the energy sector. Second is Travis Wolford, who is a partner in the Houston office at Baker Botts, with a focus on corporate advisory work, including M&A and particular expertise in the energy sector as well. I really appreciate them joining us, and we're happy to have you as well. This discussion is audio only, so you won't see our faces or any slides. So if you are looking at your computer thinking that something's wrong, it's not. This is audio only. There is a Q&A capability for those of you that joined via the internet. If you see at the bottom of your screen, there should be a chat option. So feel free to leave any questions there, and we'll address as many as we're able. As many of you know, we launched the Senior Energy Executive Discussion Series, or SEEDS Group, with our first program on March 12th, which was right before the coronavirus has kept most of us staying home. So this we're hosting a series of three virtual programs on timely topics, and this is the first of three, so we'll be following up with details on the other two and hope that we can resume some of the in-person programming when we're able. So with some of the logistics out of the way, I just want to mention a few thoughts before we jump into Q&A with our speakers. First, as the other panelists and I have been speaking this week in prep for this, we noted how different some of the advice that we have in the current industry is than what we might have shared a year ago, or honestly even a week ago, given how rapid the change is. So as the energy industry is responding to this crisis, the communications practices and the legal requirements are also evolving quite rapidly. So we're really going to focus today's discussion on the most immediate issues. We also recognize that within energy, that's a broad industry, and there's a lot of differences among the sectors on in visibility and liquidity and the audiences that matter most to them. So we'll try to speak broadly about energy, but we'll also probably dive into some sector specifics here and there. Finally, I want to mention that the first quarter reporting is going to be highly scrutinized, as I'm sure we're all anticipating. That also means a broader set of audiences than what most companies typically address, which is obviously equity and analysts. So this means we're expecting more employees, customers, vendors, even regulators and electeds to be listening in. Just want to mention that at the outset, that that should be in the back of everyone's minds as you're preparing remarks and specifically thinking about tone for the calls. So with that, I think we're ready to dive in, and I really want to start with discussion of Q1 results, because clearly these are first quarter calls, but a lot of the pressures that companies have been facing have really mounted towards the end of the quarter and even subsequent to the quarter end. So I want to start with Al Petrie. As companies are talking about their Q1 results, and in some cases even meeting expectations for the quarter, how do you talk about that when things have changed so drastically in the second quarter?
Okay, thanks, Sydney. I think that companies in their press releases are still going to cover what their results were for the first quarter, and in some cases compared to the guidance that they gave at that time. So I think, you know, companies still need to do that. But when it comes time for the call, that's where things are going to be so different this time compared to the past, because I think that companies will want to not spend a whole lot of time doing comparisons to prior quarters or to a year ago, because that's, right now that's not what investors are looking for. They really say, okay, first quarter was great, but, you know, things have changed so much. What are you doing now, and what kind of insights can you give us at this point?
So if you're veering outside of Q1 and trying to offer those types of insights, Travis, what types of obligations are you creating in terms of needing to update statements prior to the second quarter 10Q or earnings announcement, if you're talking about the second quarter in the first quarter call?
So I think it really depends on what you're going to be disclosing, and to the extent that you're putting, which you know we recommend, disclaimers of a duty to update in your disclosure documents and in your discussion. What I'd say is, to the extent that you can, you want to present it in a manner that people understand that this is just a snapshot of where you currently are on a historical basis, and then your expectations going forward, you kind of frame those separately from the historical discussion. That helps in part because there are safe harbors for forward-looking statements, so you don't want to get a muddled mix of the historical and the forward-looking statements. And the other thing to say there is that when you're looking at whether you have a formal duty to update under the law, the law's not really clear about it. I think that the phrase that the case law uses is whether the statement's material, and then whether or not it's active in the mind of investors. So the more that you can do on the front end when you're making those statements to kind of limit the expectation of investors that you're going to be updating that information, the better positioned you are to say, if you get a question, hey, so are those statements still true? You can say, well, we're not going to be updating that until the next time that we formally put out guidance or the like. And people, even when it's not this kind of a crisis situation, regularly get those inbound requests between periods. Those same lines that you use about when you're going to be providing updates to guidance, or avoiding reaffirmation of guidance and making sure that you're complying with Reg FD when you do so, that still applies. It's just we're probably going to be providing a lot more forward-looking, I shouldn't say guidance, but forward-looking expectations than you typically would, because that's really what the SEC is asking people to do right now.
So on that note, just using upstream as an example, for companies that might be planning additional shut-ins in Q2, or might be faced with the question of, are these production cuts temporary or permanent, and what's the timeline? Al, what factors are you seeing companies weigh in determining what of the Q2 decisions and pass beyond Q2 are you comfortable talking about in Q1 on the earnings call?
Sure. I think one of the things all the E&P companies have to look at, particularly right now, because I don't think there's any company that's not considering curtailment of some amount, looking at oil versus natural gas as well, too, is that, they're probably going to have to withdraw any guidance they've given previously for the full year and let people on the call know that this is a fluid situation right now, and that if they have, in fact, curtailed production at this point, then you probably need to say that. You probably also need to say that that may not necessarily be all of it, that you're looking at it. And, people may ask you, were those curtailments related to pipeline issues, or were they related to cash flow issues? That if you have fields that are truly negative cash flow, even if you can sell it, you may not want to. And if you may have, as far as taker issues for the people that take your product, they need to look at that as well. So I think that this is where it's going to be, a little more difficult for companies, because you're not providing guidance, but you're going to have to give them some sense of where you are today, what you're thinking going forward. But, I think, and this gets a little bit broader, companies need to be saying, this is part of our, short-term and medium-term strategy, which is, liquidity, balance sheet, and cash flow.
Yeah, and I just piggyback on what Al said, which is absolutely right. To some extent, when people are preparing their disclosure, they should think about what the actual line item requirements are in their 10Q and in their financial statements. So one of one of the things that I know people are going to have a lot of headaches and head scratching over are the subsequent event footnotes in the financial statements. So trying to get ahead of what you're anticipating the accountants are going to try and put into that subsequent event statement, because look, the timing of your 10Q, it's going to be a month, maybe two, if you take the extension after the first quarter has ended. And so you've got a lot of information and a lot of the actual negative impact of the pandemic and the commodity price collapse that will be affecting your disclosure. MD&A is another place where if I'm advising a company, I know that the management team wants to keep MD&A as close to business as usual as they can, but you do have a requirement to disclose known trends and uncertainties in MD&A. So the SEC has specifically said they're expecting people to put that information in there. And then obviously there are other accounting items like potential impairments that folks usually get a comment letter on. If you put your 10Q out there for Q1 and say absolutely nothing that's going to foreshadow the impairment, and then the second quarter 10Q comes along, you take an impairment and you haven't kind of laid the predicate for that, the SEC very often is going to ask a question. That happened a lot back in the 2014-2015 timeframe, and whenever companies go through negative events.
So clearly there's a lack of visibility. I think we're all in agreement that specific guidance is probably not feasible right now. That said, the SEC has recommended that companies share as much color as possible on the COVID impact in their earnings announcements. So it sounds like we're shifting from guidance to insight. What else, what does that look like though?
Sure. I think, companies are going to need to disclose what they have done so far as COVID-19 is concerned, because it's not manufacturing, but certainly we do have supply chain issues that come about with our suppliers who may be also impacted. So it's kind of that ripple effect that you can get. So I think companies need to make sure that they're talking with their operations people and finding out what type of impact have they had, because we're hearing certain things that, like you have to limit how many people are on a helicopter now. And as a result, that may be costing you more helicopters. You may have to find an alternative way to use transportation. And so I think that people need to spend, a fair amount of time looking at the cost and the impact. Certainly the first quarter, they probably have no cost. If anything, it's minimal. But there are probably things that companies are having to look at for when they do go back to work, even in their own offices, as far as how they're having to maybe reconfigure office space. So there can be some things that, even though you're more concerned about producing oil and gas, there are things that are occurring with these COVID-19 implications that I think people are going to want you to have some thoughts on that, as well as, what are you doing to reduce costs specifically to help improve your cash flow? So those could be things that you've done to ask suppliers for reductions. Have you taken any management reductions in pay? Any of the kind of G&A and LOE type cost items that you've taken some action on, even if you haven't had results yet, to let the world know that you are looking at all of those things. And if people say, what do you think you can do? You certainly can say it's too early, but they were looking at all opportunities because cash flow is so important in this environment.
Yeah, Al, when you talk about actions that the companies have taken, one thing that I think we're attuned to is avoiding a laundry list of actions, and keeping in mind that we want to share a narrative about, this is a story about responsiveness and action and leadership, and that means highlighting the key actions that you can take and the additional levers that are available to you, but not just listing every action and every option. So I think thinking about sharing how you think about each of those levers and what each lever does is probably more effective than just listing a bunch of options.
And, sure. And I think, I agree, Sydney. I think it's not going to be part of your strategy, your short-term strategy, and how does that fit in with it?
Sure. And, you know, I think when you're talking about especially survivability and enhanced disclosure about liquidity and the like, I think we start with, you know, what's good on the ship, to use an Apollo 13 analogy. You know, start with what you have and what differentiates you. You know, could be diversity of revenues, operational flexibility, a management team that's navigated other downturns. And if you don't have those things, then how are you going to get them? What's your need for capital and what access to capital do you have? What cost containment levers have you pulled? Which ones can you pull? So I think being frank about what you have and what you don't have will be important for credibility in this situation too. We've talked a little bit about guidance. Shifting to this thought about survivability, one thing that I've read a lot about but not necessarily seen a lot of yet is this idea of if-then scenarios. I can see some risk there, so I'm going to turn it over to our lawyer to offer some thoughts on if that's something that we're going to see in the calls coming up.
Yeah, I'd just start by saying I don't think that putting out a long list of potential if-then scenarios is a good idea. I think that any of those scenarios that you're going to be proposing are going to be so, it depends on the particular issuer and the industry subsector they're in, but they're probably going to be so heavily qualified by different contingencies that they really may not be meaningful. And none of them may come to fruition. Just think about how completely different the world looks today as it compared to what it did 3 weeks ago. And you're always going to be judged on your disclosure in hindsight. So I don't think that there's much value in doing so. Hal, I don't know if you have thoughts otherwise.
Yes, I fully agree with that, Travis, because, you know, I've always been a big believer in trying to provide scenario analysis to help investors and analysts understand your business. So many times in the past, when people are saying, okay, you know, what happens at $40, $50, $60 crude? And what if you invest, you know, $100 million, $150 million, or $200 million? What kind of cash flow does that generate? And you usually had, you know, a reasonable price band that you could do those kind of calculations. Now there are so many variables. You've got curtailments, you've got costs, all of those things. It's very difficult to come up with that. And one thing I'd remind companies too is that in the last quarter, a lot of companies said, we're break even at, you know, $30 crude, or we're break even at $25 crude. When they withdraw guidance, they may want to make a point to bring up that, you know, anything we have told you previously about our break even price, in today's environment, you can't rely on that any longer, because there are just too many variables. Because once you get down to these kind of prices, those kind of break-even points just don't necessarily make sense anymore. So I think companies need to, again, provide insight into the things they're trying to do, but not get too far ahead of themselves trying to come up with scenarios, because, you know, almost likely none of those things are going to be exactly right anyway.
In that example, Al, when you talked about you may have provided break-even pricing in the past, but now you've announced curtailments, production cuts, do you need, Travis, to say that those previous comments about break-even pricing shouldn't be relied on? And is it even feasible to talk about break-even pricing in the current market?
I think the feasibility for a particular company may vary, but probably for most of the operators out there, it's going to be pretty difficult to make a statement that's meaningful, other than, you know, for somebody who says, well, really I need a $50 price for me to break even, right? But that I'm not sure that that's something that people want to be saying in that particular vein. There are different ways to get to a similar point. And we can talk about, for example, the going concern discussion in a little bit. But I think that when you're trying to put these out, new numbers that would be different from your old numbers, you're going to be making a statement. Your lawyers are almost certainly going to put in there a statement that says you're disclaiming your duty to update. And so the new numbers are going to supersede the old numbers. If you don't put in a superseding number, there are ways to draft the disclosure so that you basically are saying, you know, we're withdrawing our prior guidance. And right now, if people haven't done that, it's not something to be ashamed of, right? That's more the norm at the moment, as opposed to, an outlier. Again, to what Sydney, you said at the beginning of the call, a year ago, we would have said, well, boy, if you withdraw your guidance, that's going to put you in a really bad position compared to your peers. Today, for most of the people, at least in the E&P space, that's less likely. And just one point on the guidance, if you do withdraw, I would recommend not committing to a date when you're going to start providing guidance again. We've seen a couple of people that have done that because they assumed that this was going to be shorter lived than it would. And they're now in a kind of difficult spot of, great, now I've told people that I'm going to be resuming guidance, but I really don't want to or might not be able to.
Yeah,
no, I agree with that, Travis. I think, you know, maybe one thing companies can say is that we're withdrawing guidance at this point, and while we intend to become, you know, to go back to what we're doing and being transparent, that we don't know when that's going to be, because we know this is going to have real implications for analysts and for sell-side and buy-side analysts, where they're not going to know what to do, and it's going to be a tough time. But I think that, you know, not committing to a certain time frame, but saying, you know, at the appropriate point, we will start giving you guidance again. And I guess one thing I'd bring up too is that with E&P companies, for companies that are more gas oriented than oil oriented, those guys are in pretty good shape right now. So some of the stuff would not necessarily apply to them, where they may want to continue giving guidance because they have no reason to shut in their production, and they can certainly talk about cost, and they're going to be kind of the positive thing, I think, for this first quarter reporting.
Yeah, I agree with you guys on not offering when you will resume guidance. One thing that I've seen some discussion about is, could you offer, these are the factors that we would need to see fall into place in order to feel comfortable giving guidance. So at least offering, these are the things that we're looking at rather than specific timing. So that's another option. Travis, you mentioned that a year ago things would be much different. That brings me to another topic on capital allocation of, you know, a year ago I would have said cut your dividend, your distribution, you're going to be on the front page of the paper, right? So now as companies are really in cash preservation mode, what does that mean for dividend distribution cuts? What do you expect to see, Travis, going forward in this near term?
Well, I think if somebody's got a regular dividend or regular distribution right now, we're excluding the people that have plenty of cash and plenty of liquidity, right? That's the easy case. They're going to be between a rock and a hard place, particularly if they're got a controlling stockholder that's pushing them to maintain that dividend. But the disclosure around that, you know, from a fiduciary duty perspective, people have an obligation, or that the board's going to be required to have a sufficient capital surplus to make that. And for some of these issuers, they're typically, it's a limited subset, but they may be required to actually put out some kind of financial metric in association with disclosing or declaring the dividend. So maybe you've got to throw out adjusted EBITDA because that's going to be the basis of your dividend or distribution. And if you need to do that, now you're saying, well, In a normal scenario, I would be fine putting out this particular metric, particularly if it's something that you've got to get out before the 10Q is filed. But now, what do I do? And so just briefly on the non-GAAP point, the SEC does have ways for you to provide that non-GAAP number, even on a historical basis, and reconcile it if you're, you know, kind of still trying to figure out how to reconcile EBITDA or EBITDAX or whatever it is to net income. You don't know your net income yet because you haven't fully closed out the books for a quarter, or at least you haven't made some of the difficult accounting determinations for that period. There's SEC guidance out there that allows you to provide a reasonable estimate and range. If it's a historical number, you got to do the reconciliation. If it's a forward, but to an estimate, you can do it to an estimate. If it's a forward-looking statement, there's SEC guidance that allows you just to say that the actual GAAP number is indeterminable at the time, but you've got to make an express statement associated with that.
Great. Staying on the topic of capital allocation, outside of cash preservation, the other mantra is consolidation. Curious, clearly consolidation is going to be a little bit different these days than it was a year ago as well. There's been some deals delayed, some terminated. How do you, for a company that has the balance sheet to be opportunistic, given the low valuations of some of their potential targets, how do you talk about that on the call, especially more likely in response to a Q&A? Al, I know you've seen some of that positioning companies in the current market to be opportunistic, or alternatively, if you're the company that might need to sell, how do you signal that, or should you signal that on your call?
Yes, I guess there are companies that have historically looked at doing transactions as part of their ongoing strategy. And if they've got the balance sheet and have the ability, then I don't see any problem with them continuing to say that. What I think they have to be careful with is, you know, do they really have that flexibility to do that today? So I think we need to be careful that we don't say, yeah, we're still looking and we see a lot of opportunities out there if we know, in fact, that we could not get the transaction done. But there's still a lot of companies that have prepared themselves for this kind of, not quite this bad, but certainly for a negative environment that gives them an opportunity to buy more and do consolidation. So I think those guys will continue to do that. I would be surprised that almost everybody will get a question from somebody saying, how are you looking at consolidation in the industry, whether they can, whether they're the buyer or the seller? So I think those questions will come up, something to be prepared for Q&A, but being proactive about it, if a company has done in the past and can continue to do it, I would not see a problem with that. Travis, I don't know how you feel on that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that consolidation issues and these liquidity issues and the like are ripe for questions on the Q&A, and frankly, rightly so, right? That's exactly what these investors want to know, and the analysts. When you think about it from the acquirer's perspective, people are going to care because you're probably going to have a stock price decline if you announce a transaction as the acquirer in this market, or even a month or two from now before your next Q comes out. So one of the things that we usually try to encourage people to do is to ensure that somewhere in your disclosure you have kind of the hint about one of these potential transactions. Most people are going to already have that in their 10Q buried in there somewhere. So it's not going to reflect some kind of change on a red line. But the same thing would go for potential financings, right? And when you're preparing your kind of COVID-19 pandemic disclosure, it's an opportunity to talk about, you know, flexibility or opportunistic approaches to raising capital and maintaining liquidity. And that can be something in the trends, that can be something just in the general MD&A discussion, but making sure that you've got some kind of reference in there is usually good, particularly if right now you're thinking that you may be doing a PIPE or a similar equity transaction. Getting some kind of reference in that queue, if you don't already have it, is probably a good idea.
Yeah, I think clearly companies need to be ready for that question. I think there's also going to be some very carefully worded commentary. For example, if you are trying to position yourself for a sale, saying something like, you know, clearly the industry is going through a major consolidation and we have some critical aspects of our business that we think are going to be particularly valuable, something like that. Or if you're signaling yourself as a buyer or something about, you know, we have the opportunity to look at everything that comes up for sale. We have conversations with companies all the time. We look at everything. We're open-minded. We're tuned into the fact that the industry is changing dramatically. Some of those things that is kind of like the phrase strategic alternatives, which, you know, means 100 different things. So I think there will be some very carefully worded responses to that question. And I think companies need to have that answer scripted before the call.
Yeah, just one point on the scripting. I think in normal times, people usually don't have any interest in letting their lawyers be involved in the Q&A prep. This may be one of the few times that I would actually strongly suggest that people have the lawyers look at the Q&A responses or maybe even be involved, sit in on the Q&A prep, because the lawyers really can provide some value to immunize you on those responses by putting a phrase or a couple of words over in the risk factor section. And right now, you don't want to blow up your risk factors by adding 10 extra pages, but a couple of words here and there, and you're probably going to have a separate pandemic related risk factor that's going to be added anyways. That really is cheap insurance. It just is. I'll just say this. If somebody is on the call looking at potential an insolvency event, those claims don't always or necessarily get stayed in bankruptcy if they're made against directors or management directly. So, and you know, you're not going to be looking for indemnity from the company. You're going to be looking at your insurance policy. And you're not in a really good position. So again, the cheap insurance, it's worth, as the lawyer, obviously, I say it's worth it, but I do think that an ounce of prevention is good.
No, I agree with that, Travis. It may not have been the normal process in the past, but again, to this time, because you're going to be getting questions and you're not providing guidance, you're going to want to be very careful with the kind of things that you do say, that they don't come back to haunt you sometime in the future.
Yeah, Al, on the topic of Q&A prep, clearly that's going to be an expanded process this quarter. What are some questions that you think we need to be thinking about that might not be on everyone's radar already?
Yeah, it's a pretty wide range, and a lot of these are very specific to the individual companies. Because, you know, some of the ones that could be going on right now is that, you know, almost all the E&Ps are going through their semi-annual redeterminations. And, you know, great if you've gotten it done and you can tell people where you stand. But I think you're going to get a lot of Q&A from people if you haven't done it, saying, have you talked to the banks? What are you hearing from the banks? What kind of price deck? Are they going to cut you from where you are? You know, what are you looking at as far as additional sources of liquidity, because I think liquidity is going to be so paramount important that people you're going to have people asking, you know, five different ways the same question about, you know, what is your access to additional capital if you need it, and how far are you willing to go to issue equity in an environment like this? You know, is the debt market totally dead, or are there alternative uses? Because we're hearing from people on an almost daily basis saying, Al, if you've got clients that are looking for capital, let me know, because, you know, we do have dry powder and we're willing to get creative. So I think you're going to get those kind of questions that the company, you know, needs to be prepared how they will answer that, because I think that's certainly going to be of a lot of importance. And I guess without just going through a long list, you know, strategy is going to be very important too. Is that if you're not giving guidance and people don't know which way things are going, you know, how are you going, how are you looking at things, and what is your strategy? Because I think some companies are going to be looking at this as an opportunity to say, you know, nobody likes to talk about production declines, but if we have fields that are no longer economic, even at, say, $40 crude, is this the time to say, let's go ahead and, you know, shut those things in, get our production down to a manageable level when the street will not be upset about that? So I think that, you know, companies need to be a lot more fulsome in their disclosures, saying that they're looking at a lot of different things, not just curtailing production today because they can't sell it, but looking at, you know, what makes the most economic sense, and as part of a strategy to maximize cash flow and to be able to work within cash flow in the future with their drilling.
Yeah, I want to stay on that point about the discussion of liquidity too. Travis, on the enhanced disclosure, what do you expect to see in discussions of liquidity and survivability and that whole topic?
Yeah, so I think when people are looking at preparing their liquidity and capital resources section and the like, you really, I mean, the SEC has actually been pretty clear that they're reminding people to look at things like ability to service debts and other financial obligations, access to debt and equity markets, to the extent that there's any kind of, for lack of a better word, a mismatch between your liquidity runway and your capital needs, either for particular assets or for the business more generally. To the extent that you had, you know, impairments or changes in your collateral valuation that might trigger a covenant or the like, if you've got counterparty issues, on Al's point about the borrowing base redeterminations, you know, some people's RBLs allow the banks to make a redetermination in between periods. And so if you have a sense that you're going to get whacked by one of the banks, kind of laying the predicate for that is a good idea. And a lot of these things, you know, management is going to be aware of most of them, but making sure that you've got pretty tight controls over financial reporting will help, you know, bring some of these issues to light. You definitely don't want to be caught in a situation where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing on this.
Sure, Travis. And one more thing in that regard, too, on liquidity. A question that could come up that people need to be prepared for is, would you consider doing a drawdown of your revolver now and proactively to maximize your liquidity? And everybody knows when you do that, that can be a pretty bad signal. But I think there will be companies that will be doing that. Certainly some very large non-energy companies are doing that today that have no, you know, inclination of going bankrupt, but they want as much liquidity as they can. So you've been seeing some of the really large corporations saying, this pandemic is having a far-reaching impact, and I need to make sure I can pay my people, do what I need to do, because, you know, my working capital could be an issue for me in the short term. So I think companies will get those kind of questions as well, and they just have to weigh, you know, in energy, when you draw down your revolver, it has a tendency to mean not good things.
Yeah, and to the point of kind of sources of liquidity, one thing that I think folks will get questions on are, which of the government programs have you availed yourself of? So there are some people that may have taken out a PPP loan and maybe they didn't think it was material, so they didn't put out a disclosure in the 8A, but then in the 10Q, they're going to disclose that, you know, either in the financial statements or otherwise, or one of the other programs that, you know, either currently is in place or will be put in place over the next few months. Maybe there's even something specific to the energy industry. Making sure that you're, you know, keeping track of disclosing those is important, because those programs may change, or they may have conditions or certifications associated with them that are important. So for example, the PPP loan buried on that, it was a short application, but one of the things that it said was, you certify that the current volatility and economic uncertainty makes the loan necessary to support your ongoing operations. And so some people have found themselves in a little bit of a trap where they say, well, you know, that might have been true at the time that I made the statement. I'm assuming that people always read their reps. That's what lawyers always assume. But some of these programs, the applications, may have little gotchas on there where you disclose, well, I borrowed under PPP, and then you get the question on the Q&A of, so tell me why, you know, a maximum $10 million loan was necessary to support your ongoing operations. That doesn't really comport with what you're telling me about your liquidity profile.
You talked about financial controls, which are, you know, more difficult in a work from home environment. And you mentioned borrowing base redeterminations that are in some cases coming up pretty soon. All of that complicates the earnings process and timing. We know that the SEC allowed a 45-day filing extension, but there's some parameters for when that's feasible and allowable. And we haven't really seen many companies use that. So Al, are you seeing more companies doing that, or do you expect to, or does it really signal something more than just COVID-related issues?
Yeah, we're certainly monitoring that very closely, because I think, you know, typically your larger companies report first, and those guys have already done that and did not avail themselves of the extension. But I think the smaller companies are waiting to see what others do in that regard. I think that, you know, most companies, the smaller ones in particular, would like to have a little bit more time if they have issues that are ongoing, that they may have more clarity, you know, say by late May as opposed to early May. But, you know, I think people are very concerned. They don't want to be the only one who doesn't report under normal circumstances, but they're really just getting into that process now. And there are a lot of factors that they have to look at, you know, that are COVID related, which is, do they have the capabilities to get all of their work done, get the, you know, the auditors to do their work that they got to do, and to make sure that they've got all the disclosures they need in the 10Q that Travis may want to talk some more about, because there's a lot of new stuff. And when you're doing this remotely and having to coordinate all of that, that additional time could be valuable, but we haven't seen that happen yet. We're still watching to see, but again, the smaller companies have not shown their hand yet to a large degree to have announced their calls yet.
Yeah, I think that there are a couple things to keep in mind about the extension. One is, it's not just I want to take an extension, so I'm going to take an extension. You actually have to have some kind of need related to taking that extension. There has to be a disclosed reason why you're not able to get your 10Q on file. And maybe that is an issuer takes the position that it's as simple as, well, we've got a lot of accounting judgments that we have to make, to Al's point, and, you know, doing it from a work from home, and our accountants can't actually get on site and do the work they need to support our management's judgments, that's going to be difficult. And look, the accounting judgments, like Al mentioned, things like your subsequent events, your impairments, fair value, debt modifications, restructurings, hedging, revenue recognition right now, Going concern, that's a really big one that I think a lot of people are going to have to grapple with. You know, the idea there is in these interim financial statements, it's really on management to drive that process. And all you have to have is substantial doubt about whether the company is going to continue as a going concern. Then you need to start discussing your mitigation plans, the probability of success, and the like. Trying to deal with all of these accounting judgments are going to require, you know, your senior financial management, your audit committee, the auditors, and everybody else to put their heads together. I think that a lot of the regular things that companies may take for granted in the process of putting together their financial statements are going to take a lot longer than they normally do. That being said, if somebody does want to take advantage of the extension, you don't just cross the deadline and then file your 10Q later, or get right up to the edge and then say, oh, well, you know, we'll file it tomorrow. And that may be an issue, because the person who actually presses the button for your company to file the 10Q may get sick or might not be available, or you've got a financial printer where they've outsourced it to India and they're under stress from the pandemic. If you do want to take advantage of the extension, you need to be prepared to do so. It needs to be part of your disclosure plan and part of a timing plan, because you need to file an 8K on a timely basis.
Got it. I want to circle back to what we were talking about with valuations depressed and what that means for capital allocation and being opportunistic even. Al, you had mentioned poison pills. We've seen a lot of preemptive pills. We've seen some NOL poison pills. What do you expect the questions to be on that front and the practices going forward?
I'll let Travis answer some of the more specifics about what they're seeing from their end on poison pills. But I know a lot of companies are looking at that, you know, just being concerned that, you know, there are people out there that are watching what these companies are doing stock-wise that may not be really indicative of their real runway. So I think people are looking at, is this the appropriate time to do that? I think, you know, a lot of them are a little nervous because they're right in the middle of proxy season right now. So to announce that right before the annual general meeting and create an issue with ISS or Glass Lewis, that it appears that if they're short term, ISS and Glass Lewis will be a little more accepting of that. But I think Travis may have a little bit more that he can say in that regard.
So I'll say the pill activity right now, I think in the last 2 months, is more than it was all of last year. Definitely on putting things on the shelf. And for those that haven't dealt with a pill in a while, what I mean by putting it on the shelf is you actually have the lawyers go through and draft all of the documents, get it all together. That's important, because there's actually diligence involved to make sure that there aren't restrictions in your credit facility or maybe some minority investor that restrict you from actually adopting the pill, or that you've got sufficient authorized shares. So I think that because the kind of statutory framework for advance notice of somebody taking a position is ineffective, frankly, you know, they can take a 5% position and wait 10 days and then keep acquiring before they have to tell you about it. That for larger companies, that's not as important, because HSR will cut you off at, like, I think this year it's $94 million worth of stock. But there are ways with derivatives to get around that. But that's really why you're seeing so many people in a depressed commodity environment that leads to very significantly depressed stock prices actually adopt the pills. If your market cap, I think one of the banks was saying, if you're under $1 billion, you should seriously consider actually adopting the pill as opposed to just putting it on the shelf, because I mean, it can take such a large stake in your stock at this point. When you do adopt a pill, it can have a negative effect on your stock price. Sometimes it has a positive effect on the stock price, but it's something to keep in mind. And then in terms of what people are adopting, I don't think NOL pills are going to be that popular in the next few months. Probably in the latter half of the year they will, as people realize they've got, you know, significant NOLs to protect. That's kind of what happened in 2008, 2009 with the financial crisis. But right now, what we're generally talking to people about is a pill of 1 year or less. Whether or not you absolutely need to get stockholder approval is, I think it's less likely that somebody's going to seek prior, well, people are not going to seek prior approval of the pill. So it's a question of whether you need to seek ratification. And there, you know, you adopt the pill and then you ask your investors, you have the conversation with them, as opposed to actually committing up front to do so. And all of this assumes that you're adopting kind of a regular way, short-term pill that doesn't have any crazy features that ISS is going to throw up over. But definitely people are looking at that, particularly in terms of they put out their earnings and they provide their 10Q and then say, well, we think our stock's going to go down even further, so maybe we should have that pill ready to go.
Yeah, and that's certainly a change since a year or two ago where you would be really frowned upon and you'd be putting yourself in the crosshairs for ISS and Glass Lewis and the like. So that's definitely a change. And I think as long as it is short duration and the trigger is not at too low of a level, I think ISS has even said that they are okay with some of those. So big change. I want to shift and talk about the government intervention question. I know there's a lot of different programs. There's a lot of discussion for Texas producers with the Railroad Commission. There's a lot of uncertainty there as to what relief could look like and disagreement within the industry. What we know that companies are going to get the question, though. So how do you thread the needle in talking about expectations for government actions? Maybe starting with you, Al.
Yes, you know, I guess what I'd be thinking about initially is, you know, if they've applied for the PPP loans or anything like that, you know, for the smaller companies, they're not on the, you know, the front lines as far as talking about what the Texas Railroad Commission is doing. You know, they're more focused on, you know, trying to see what can they do to keep their production going if it makes sense. So I think more from the government intervention. Travis, do you have any thoughts on that? For I'd say the smaller companies, they're going to be watching to see what others are saying. But, you know, other than applying for the grants that they've got, you know, there was a while, a period there when Trump had mentioned that he was considering shutting in production in the Gulf of Mexico. Well, that never really made it to the producers themselves. But as it turns out, as was shown in an article in Wall Street Journal, you know, two of the private companies actually have shut it in already. So I think things like that, each company's have to look at it on their own. But Travis, I don't know what you're seeing on your end.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think that from the government intervention perspective, some of the things that people think may be, you know, helpful may actually be harmful. So I definitely think government intervention is a risk factor for a lot of companies. And even if you don't see it right now, it should be something when you're disclosing, you know, your coronavirus risk factor, that those activities of the government may hurt you. That may be as simple as, well, a stay in place order is requiring people to stay home, so that's affecting my demand or my ability to have employees show up at work. But it can also be something like, you know, as you mentioned, the Railroad Commission and per rationing. If you'd asked me 2 weeks ago, I would have said that's dead on arrival. It's not going to happen. If you talk to me now, I don't really have a clear answer of where that's going to go. And we've got regulatory lawyers that, you know, are doing webinars every single day about it. as each one of these meetings happens, but we don't know where it's going to go. And the government, when they do institute these new policies and programs, it winds up picking winners and losers. That's just a function of regulatory intervention. And until you know exactly what the contours of that program are, you don't know whether you're going to be the winner or you're going to be the loser. So I do think that, you know, we want to put in disclosure about how that might be helpful if you think that that's relevant, but it's good to have something in the risk factors about how government intervention, particularly if you're in the energy industry, might be a negative.
And I want to mention maybe a counterintuitive thought on the government intervention question. You know, right now, I think ESG issues are somewhat eclipsed at the moment by some of the discussion about liquidity and the like. That said, if there is some sort of bailout, especially where taxpayers become equity owners or otherwise help to bail out an industry, I think that there will be more scrutiny of these companies, including their ESG-related practices. So although it's not as top of mind for some companies, I think we can't lose sight of the sustainability questions, especially given what could be happening on the government side. So
that's a great point.
Yeah, I want to, I know we're close to being out of time. I want to mention something that's tactical and not as strategic, but in a normal earnings call, you've got the whole management team around a table, and during Q&A, you can kind of point to each other, you can jot down notes, and you usually have a whiteboard with some of the key messages up on there that you can refer to, some of the key metrics. Doing this virtually, I think companies so far have done a really great job of making it work, but there are tools. I think everyone should try to join via video with their colleagues on mute so that they can see each other and have a Sharpie in your hand and ready to write notes to each other and hold them up to the screen. So we're going to have to just get a little space age with that. I think the IR person can really serve as the train conductor in some of that. And where you won't have the whiteboard with the key messages, make sure you've got a piece of paper in front of you with your core messages so that during your Q&A session, you always can refer back to what you want to be sure and hit on in your remarks. So think virtual when you're thinking about some of these tactical questions as well. I think we're about out of time. Travis and Al, anything that you'd want to mention that we haven't had a chance to touch on? Closing thoughts?
I guess one thing that I'd mention from the lawyer's perspective is if you've got a merger agreement that's already signed, or if you're going to be signing one, or you've got, you know, your commercial contracts that have force majeure provisions, you should remember that somebody that's suing you is going to look at your Q&A and is going to look at your 10-Q and your disclosure and will use that in a court of law when asserting that an MAE has occurred with respect to you or a force majeure has occurred with a contract. So don't compartmentalize all of these different issues in your mind. You've got to keep all of it together as you're looking at this disclosure.
Sure. And I guess my closing comment would be, as we opened it up, clearly this call is going to be the most different in many, many years. In fact, it may be the most different that I've ever seen compared to what we've accustomed to seeing. So I think companies need to make sure they really get themselves prepared for the call, because the text part, the prepared remarks may be shorter because of not having guidance and not wanting to go through a lot of comparison of numbers that people aren't going to care about. But certainly that Q&A is going to be so important to be prepared for that and then decide how much of that they want to be proactive with as far as providing that in their scripted remarks.
Yeah, and I would say ordinarily we tell clients you don't want to have big shifts in body language in how you present your story each quarter. I think this is an exception. Your core strategy's got to be the same, but and if you need to shift how you offer guidance, for example, or what metrics you offer, if you need to make it more anecdotal and insights, I think that you're not setting any sort of precedent in terms of expectations to do the same thing in the future. Everyone knows this is a little bit of a unique situation. And so I do think it's a good chance to rethink some of your practices. I know Alan, Travis, and I would all be happy to speak further if there are questions that we didn't get to today. We appreciate you joining, and I want to thank Travis and Al as well for sharing their insights with us. And we look forward to sharing information on our next program in 2 weeks.
Thank you, Sydney.
Thanks, Sydney.
Bye-bye.